Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Once a boomtown of the Industrial Revolution, Rochdale in northwest England has been reliably labor for years, until now. This was an election that saw allegations of fraud, desperate attempts like this one by the right-wing Reform Party.
Make sure you prevent George Galloway from being your MP for Rochdale.
And dominated by the massacre in Gaza.
From the river to the sea.
The result came hours after polls closed.
Hereby declare that George Galloway is duly elected.
A sweeping victory for a veteran anti-war pro-Palestine campaigner who reminded everyone that the anger in Britain over the Gaza genocide is not confined to the Muslim community only.
Every Muslim is bitterly angry at Keir Starmer and his misnamed Labour Party. But you would be very foolish if you did not realize that millions of other citizens of our country are.
Rochdale is home to a 30,000-strong Muslim community.
George Galloway from Rochdale.
Apart from bread-and-butter issues such as the declining public services, unemployment, poverty and crime that have racked the constituency for years, for the majority of the voters here, there was more to take into account.
This as a blessing to basically take our word straight to Parliament, and if one person just goes in there and asks for a ceasefire, asks for all these genocide to stop, it's more than any Labour candidate or Labour MP or anyone has done for many years.
He can bring change to us locally, but also nationally and internationally. So the thing is, the ongoing issue with Gaza is a big issue, and it's an international issue. But at the same time, it's not just a Muslim issue. It's about human rights.
The election was triggered by the death in January of opposition Labour Party MP Tony Lloyd. He was replaced by this man, Azhar Ali. On voting day, though, Labour's campaign centre lay shuttered after the party abandoned Ali for making anti-Israel remarks.
By-elections don't always represent the wider national picture. They are protest votes with a local focus. Last time around, Labour won the seat here by 10,000 votes, but this time they lost. And perhaps that is a sign of what's to come, both for Labour and the Conservatives, with the general elections only months away. Saeed Poreza, Rochdale, Greater Manchester.
On Thursday, a demonstration was staged in Rome's Parliament Square in protest against the arrest of Anan Yaish, a 37-year-old Palestinian citizen from Tulkarm in the West Bank. Anan was arrested without charge or justifiable cause by the Italian police in the central Italy mountain city of L'Aquila on January 29 on an extradition request by the Israeli government, which Italy's justice ministry acquiesced straight away. A month later, Anan, who holds a valid residence permit in Italy since 2017, is still detained in a prison wing housing only terrorists in the city of Terni.
Anan's detention is similar to Israel's administrative detention, when a person is kept in prison without trial, without having committed an offence. Israel even wants to intimidate the Palestinians who live abroad.
Israel believes Anan has committed one and only very serious offence. He has not given up the fight. That's why they are behind him. Italy is surveillance subservient as usual with Israel. Our authorities have arrested an innocent man who is just a member of the Palestinian resistance.
During the demonstration, activists strongly condemned Italy's government for its complicity in the genocide in Gaza.
We know full well how heavy Israel's influence is on the Italian government. Prime Minister Meloni wanted to ban pro-Palestine demonstrations. We have seen her going hand in hand with Netanyahu.
More pro-Palestine protests will be held in Italy at the weekend. Large demonstrations will take place in Rome, Florence and Pisa. Meanwhile, a group of Italian lawmakers announced they will travel to the Rafah border between the Gaza Strip and Egypt. They say they want to provide the Italian government with a testimony of the tragedy the Palestinians are experiencing as a result of Israel's crimes. Max Civili, Rome.
The new satellite Pars 1 aboard Soyuz launch vehicle was blasted off from a Russian space base and successfully put into orbit 500 kilometers above Earth. The imaging and research satellite will provide a set of remote sensing data that can be used in various fields, including land, forest, water monitoring, and mining and energy transmission lines. The domestically made satellite weighs nearly 150 kilograms and is capable to capture images of 95% of Iranian territory.
The Pars 1 satellite is a two-way researching satellite built by the Iran Space Research Institute and has three types of applications for collecting data from the Earth's surface. The first payload of the color spectrum with an accuracy of 15 meters, the second payload with an accuracy of 150 meters for thermal imaging, and a payload with 300 meters accuracy for imaging with shortwave infrared spectra, which is used to identify plant and forestry pests.
Some Iranians gathered in the country's Space Research Institute to watch the event and express their thoughts about this launch.
We're very proud of this moment. This cooperation between the two countries shows the country's development in international interactions.
I came here today to see this proud moment, and I hope that in the future I can play an influential role in Iran's technological developments.
Pars 1 is designed and manufactured by experts and young scientists with the cooperation of knowledge-based companies. This is the second foreign launch of Iranian satellite. Last year, Iran launched Khayyam satellite from a space launching pad in Kazakhstan. Iran is among the world's top 10 countries capable of developing and launching satellites.
The latest launch is an important step forward in the country's space program. Despite sanctions imposed by Western countries in recent years, Iran is excelling in a wide range of technological developments, including in the space sector. Farzana Shuryong, Tehran.
Pakistan's newly elected lower house of the parliament met for the first time on Thursday with freshly elected members taking oaths amid protests on the floor by the supporters of jailed former premier Imran Khan. They called for an audit of the recently held polls in the country.
We will bring back our beloved leader Imran Khan along with the mainstream leadership of our party with the power vested in the newly formed parliament. We demanded on the floor of the House that the chief election commissioner and officials of the electoral body should step down immediately because they were involved in poll rigging and manipulation of results.
Although candidates supported by the imprisoned Khan secured the majority of seats in the country's National Assembly, the Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz and Pakistan People's Party, along with their political allies, have united in an alliance to establish a coalition government. They have nominated former Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif as their candidate for the country's chief executive position for a second term. Khan's opponents say that the democracy has emerged victorious, while those setting up obstacles in the way of country's progress and prosperity have been defeated.
We consider Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf as a roadblock to the country's progress and prosperity.
They are attempting to sabotage democracy through the rhetoric of poll rigging and are striving to foment anarchy in the country.
Efforts from the government coalition to persuade its former key ally have encountered a hurdle with the leader of Pakistan's primary religious political faction, affirming its decision to refrain from participating in the formation of the government. Once the head of the former coalition, the chief of Jamiat Ulama-e-Islam, Maulana Fazlur Rahman, parted ways with the newly formed coalition and decided not to be involved in forming the new government.
A hung parliament in Pakistan has been sworn in amid allegations of poll rigging and results manipulation. Experts say that the formation of a coalition government in the country with a split mandate would face severe political challenges in the days to come. Nasik Azmi, Islamabad.
As a result of a broad consensus in Iraq to end the presence of U.S.-led international coalition forces from the country, both the Iraqi nation and government made it crystal clear that these military forces are no longer needed. Iraqi National Security Advisor Qasem al-A'raji stated that all political factions in the country have agreed on the need to end the presence of U.S.-led military coalition purportedly formed to fight Daesh terrorist group.
Today, we're witnessing the negotiation with the international coalition forces, and honestly, what makes us the Iraqi people exasperated is the insistence by the U.S. to keep its troops on our land to have an intervention in the military scene of Iraq and neighboring Syria.
Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani stated that the Western Alliance mission will end at the Baghdad government's official request. He also said that the government is setting a date for the start of bilateral committee talks, which includes representatives of the military coalition to put arrangements to end the presence of international coalition forces in Iraq permanently.
We have collected more than 100 signatures and prepared the legal draft to end the international coalition mission in Iraq. And we pledge before God to our people that we will enact the law to expel the foreign forces from our land.
The demands to end U.S. military presence in Iraq are not new. After Washington's assassination of top Iraqi and Iranian anti-terror commanders, General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mehdi al-Muhandis 4 years ago, Iraqi parliament voted to expel foreign forces who can endanger security and stability in Iraq and jeopardize civil peace. Following the recent attacks on anti-terror forces and the continued violations on the country's sovereignty, the Iraqi nation and government are now determined to end the presence of foreign military forces to prevent any further escalations that can endanger the stability and security of Iraq. Muslim Salim, Baghdad.
Celebrating Iran's efforts and the evolution of its multilateral cooperation over the past century, the virtual exhibition of images, documents, and videos entitled Iran in 100 Years of Multilateralism looks at key milestones and achievements of Iran as an active member in international organizations, illustrating them with rarely seen historical photos, documents, and contemporary visuals.
The idea of setting up an exhibition like this one was proposed about 7 months ago. The main objective was to create a reliable source for research purposes. However, when we started collecting information and documents, we realized that the role that Iran has played in international organizations has been so significant that it deserves to be presented to the public.
This is also in line with Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi's approach.
Multilateralism is very important. It is the only way to circumvent U.S. sanctions. Our people should be united, and I'm pleased to see that Iran is promoting multilateralism. BRICS is a symbol of this new policy, giving the Global South a voice.
This comes as the foreign minister has just wrapped up a two-day trip to Geneva, packed with bilateral meetings, not only with his counterparts from different countries from around the world discussing issues of bilateral concern, but also with high-ranking officials in the United Nations, including UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, the High Commissioner for Human Rights, and President of the International Committee of the Red Cross, ICRC, all in line with rallying support for Palestinians under constant Israeli attacks.
I'm here in Geneva to reiterate Iran's stance on the current developments. Our government's policy is based on creating a network of cooperation and promoting multilateralism, because we believe this is the best way to overcome the challenges that we are facing.
Meanwhile, Iran's foreign minister used the opportunity to draw attention to Israel's long history of unlawful behavior during the UN conference on disarmament.
The Iranian foreign minister called on the international community to demand the immediate nuclear disarmament of the Israeli regime.
And the special high-level meeting held on the sidelines of the 55th session of the UN Human Rights Council on the dire humanitarian situation in Gaza once again highlighted Iran's role as a country that prioritizes multilateral cooperation. Gisumisha Ahmadip, Geneva.
Palestinians have taken to the streets across the occupied West Bank to protest against the Israeli genocide on the Gaza Strip as it nears 150 days. Despite the bad weather and heavy rain, protesters roam the streets of Ramallah chanting for Gaza and demanding an end to Israel's war on the besieged Strip. People here say that Israel is using the war on Gaza to escalate its military measures in the West Bank.
Despite the Israeli non-stop crimes against our people and attempts to break their will, the Palestinians there in Gaza are steadfast and the resistance is still fighting. Wherever the Palestinians are, they are facing the Israeli illegal plans and violence and the killing that is everywhere, settlement expansion, Judaization attempts, and now the Israeli plans of eviction and attempts to break the resistance in Gaza that all Palestinians are embracing.
Also, amongst the demands of the Palestinian protesters is to shed the light to the suffering of the thousands of prisoners incarcerated in Israeli jails under inhumane condition. In addition to the fact that the Israeli regime is using the illegal administrative detention that allows it to keep Palestinians behind bars without charge or trial.
Prisoners are being held under a disastrous situation in Israeli jails. 7,300 were detained from the West Bank and over 2,000 from the Gaza Strip since the 7th of October. And we should not forget that over 4,000 have already been imprisoned before. So we're talking today about over 11,500 prisoners who are being tortured, humiliated, and maltreated. Hundreds are in serious health condition and they're facing a slow death.
With all eyes are focused on the Gaza Strip, Israeli regime continues stepping up its violence here in the occupied West Bank. The Israeli forces shot dead 4 Palestinians in separate incidents in Al-Farah refugee camp and Tobas town, northeast Nablus, and at Mazmouria checkpoint near Bethlehem, bringing the number of Palestinians killed in the West Bank since the start of the war on Gaza to 411. Protesters today are stressing that no one is getting used to the Israeli genocide in the besieged Gaza Strip at the time when the regime's atrocities against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank are on the rise. They say this is the least they can do to express their anger, to express their support to their fellow Palestinians in Gaza, and to show them that they are not alone. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime genocide in Gaza will be remembered as the moral collapse of the West. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, "Now that some Western leaders have begun to feel increasingly uncomfortable as the enormity of the Gaza genocide unfolds, a few, though bashfully, are declaring that Netanyahu may be going too far.
The Zionist regime's genocide in Gaza will be remembered as the moral collapse of the West. As soon as the Israeli regime war began following the Al-Aqsa flood operation on October 7th, every moral or legal frame of reference that Washington and its Western allies supposedly held dear was suddenly dropped. Western leaders rushed to Israel, one after the other, offering military, political, and intelligence support, along with a blank check to right-wing Zionist Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his generals to torment the Palestinians. The likes of the U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, went as far as joining the Zionist regime's first War Council meeting so that he could take part in the discussion which directly resulted in the Gaza genocide. He said on October 12th, "I come before you not only as the United States Secretary of State, but also as a Jew." The interpretation of these words is disturbing, no matter how it is spun. But it also ultimately means that Blinken has lost all credibility as an American, as a politician, or even as a fair-minded human being. His boss, President Joe Biden, as if in an infinite loop, has been, for years, repeating that you don't have to be a Jewish to be a Zionist. Indeed, he has lived up to his maximum, declaring time and again, "I am a Zionist." Indeed, he is. Like many other U.S. and Western officials and politicians, the United States president abandoned international and humanitarian laws altogether, even the law of his own country. The Leahy Law prohibits the U.S. Department of State and Department of Defense from providing military assistance to foreign security force units that violate human rights with impunity. Instead, he, like Blinken, subscribed to tribal affiliation and ideological notions, which simply added fuel to the fire. Though protected persons under international law, Palestinians seem dispensable, in fact, irrelevant to the point that their collective death appears critical for Israel to regain its deterrence and to protect itself, in the words of the Zionist regime's Minister of War, Yoav Gallant, against the human animals of Gaza. If there is a stronger word than hypocrisy, one would have used it, but for now, it would have to suffice. When the EU foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, was asked point blank in an Al Jazeera interview on November 20 about the violations of international law in Gaza, he offered two completely different answers. "I am not a lawyer," he said, when the legality of the Zionist regime's atrocities in Gaza were questioned. When the interviewer shifted to talk about Al-Aqsa flood, Borrell had no qualms about the issue. He said, "Yes, we consider that a war crime for killing civilians in this apparent way without any reason." This episode has not been repeated often in the US media simply because few mainstream media journalists are bothered or, more accurately, dare to question the Zionist regime's grisly behavior in the Gaza Strip. However, when such opportunities arose, the flagrant hypocrisy was impossible to hide. Marvel, for example, at Matthew Miller, spokesperson for the U.S. State Department, in response to rape allegations in both Gaza and Israel, when he was asked on February 18th about allegations of rape by the Zionist regime troops of Palestinian women In the Gaza Strip, his answer was that the U.S. has urged Israel to thoroughly and transparently investigate credible allegations. Compare this to his response to a question about unverifiable allegations of sexual assaults made by Palestinians against Israelis, although debunked even by the Zionist regime's own media. They have committed rape. We have no reason at all to doubt those reports, he said at a press conference on December 4th. Such examples are produced daily by hundreds of Western leaders, top officials, and media organizations. Even now, when the death toll has broken all records of brutality in recent human history, they still speak of the Zionist regime's right to defend itself, willfully ignoring the fact that the child killer regime of Israel has forfeited this right as soon as it engaged in this prolonged aggression starting in 1948. Indeed, international law on the rules of war and military occupation is situated within a framework notably laid out by the Fourth Geneva Convention that exists to defend the rights of the occupied, not the right of the occupier. This time-honored truth is obvious to the vast majority of humanity, save Washington and a few others, as dozens of envoys from around the world testified before the International Court of Justice from February 19th to 26th, protesting the Zionist regime's horrific violence, protracted occupation and racial system of apartheid. The United States sent its envoy to the highest court in the world to lobby for something else entirely. With the ironic title of acting legal advisor for the U.S. State Department, Richard Visick bizarrely urged the ICJ to ignore international law altogether. He said, "The court should not find that Israel is legally obligated to immediately and unconditionally withdraw from occupied territory." For far too long, but especially since October 7th, Western regimes, starting with the U.S. regime, have violated every last set of ethics, morality, and laws that they themselves developed, drafted, promoted, even imposed on the rest of the world for many decades. Currently, they are practically dismantling their own laws and the very ethical standards that led to their formation. Now that some Western leaders have begun to feel increasingly uncomfortable as the enormity of the Gaza genocide unfolds, a few, though bashfully, are declaring that Netanyahu may be going too far. Even so, not even an outright admission of responsibility would erase the fact that they are active participants in Netanyahu's killing campaign. When all is said and done, the blood of the horrifyingly high number of Palestinian victims will be shared equally between Tel Aviv, Brussels, London, Sydney, and all other genocide apologists. A crime of this magnitude will never be forgotten or forgiven.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Spotlight. Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, is there any horror that the Palestinians in Gaza have not gone through since October? These people have been starved, denied water, electricity, gas, and at times communications. They've been bombed by planes, tanks, drones, snipers, and they have been kidnapped, raped, tortured, and imprisoned. And on Thursday, even they were bombed while in line trying to get flour for their starving families in what is being called the Flour Massacre. It's just another massacre in a long line of so many others in Gaza. All of this while there's still talk of a ceasefire, but no action of really implementing one. How many more Palestinians must be killed before the powers that be say enough? I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Out of Montreal, author and political activist Yves Engler. And out of Tehran, Ali Salam, editor-in-chief Basira Press.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you both for being with us. I'll start this off in Montreal. And Yves, on Thursday, the Flour Massacre took place where at least 112 more Palestinians were killed and over 750 injured. Officials of the Israeli regime have been very smug with their explanations and basically say the hungry masses, Palestinians, brought this on themselves due to attacking the humanitarian trucks. I mean, your thoughts on all of this and seeing that scene, what went through your mind?
They keep doing things that are even worse than one would imagine they could do. The bar just keeps going lower and lower. The Israeli propaganda response, the denying it, and then some of their spokespeople saying, oh yeah, we did kill some people, but they deserved it because they threatened us. And then seeing all these apologists for Israel's genocide on social media, just denying it all happened. It's hard to wrap one's head around. There's complicity shared around all of the self-described democracies and human rights countries of the West are enabling this, starving people trying to get some food being mowed down by a occupying power that has been put them under siege for two decades, that drove them from their homes 75 years ago and has been regularly terrorizing Palestinians of Gaza.
Well, Ali, do you think the bottom line is that to the Western powers that be, Palestinians and the people of this region are basically seen as less than?
It's in their own words, as we heard from various statements, the words such as human animals, and some of them said that, no, we shouldn't use the term human animals because that's even an insult to animals themselves. So what is going on and what you and our guests have described is 100% deliberate. It's not accidental. And then when they lie about it, the lies are also deliberate. Their lies have been torn apart now. Even the one who concocted the lies of the mass rape story has had to essentially quietly admit that it was a totally uncredible story. But that gets buried and that doesn't get shown in the front pages. But people are losing their accounts on social media for telling these truths. People are called, like, I don't even know, what are they calling, rape deniers or all these other types of terms. The Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, said that if we don't expose the truth about these lies and that there's no evidence for their claims, that it all comes from these dubious IDF sources, we can see the dead Palestinian children every single day. If there was really one single dead or beheaded Palestinian child that wasn't generated by some AI image generator, as was in one case on social media, they would have no shame in plastering it around the world and making it poster that they would show on all the screens in Times Square, and they would shine on the, I don't know, all the famous buildings in Europe with high-powered projectors. They would shove it in our face, but they can't. They only have hearsay. But all these people are dying and being intentionally murdered and mowed down based on these lies, as an excuse to cover up their pre-planned, premeditated mass slaughter of Palestinians in Gaza.
Well, Eves, can you think of any part of the Western world that, if more than 30,000 civilians would have been killed, that nothing would have still been done by now to stop this murder?
No, I mean, there are lots of crimes in the imperial history. Look at what the U.S. did in Iraq in 2003. I mean, they hundreds of thousands, hundreds and hundreds of thousands were killed as a result. So
Western world, because I know, unfortunately, as was just talked about, in this part of the world, people seem to be disposable. But in the West, if something like this had happened, would they have allowed this to continue?
Well, we don't need to. I mean, we can just look at what they're doing with regards to Ukraine right now, where, you know, the UN says over 2 years, a bit over 10,000 Ukrainian civilians have been killed. Israel did that in, you know, probably the first 30 or 40 days of this onslaught on Gaza. The Canadian government's reaction, U.S. government, is to pump in huge amounts of weapons, all kinds of sanctions on Russia, on and on and on. There is no doubt our political culture in Canada specifically, but North America, the NATO countries, treats Palestinians as to frame it as lesser is to use too light of language. I mean, the you look at a situation like the Israeli quote unquote hostages that are in Gaza. There's all this focus still put on this question, but this is completely irrelevant if you look at this issue from a big picture humanist perspective. I mean, there's thousands of Palestinian children who have lost limbs. And you don't even, that issue is just never even like mentioned in our media, but we'll hear endlessly about some Israeli soldiers that are still being, held so that all the thousands and thousands of Palestinian prisoners, that they can maybe get the release of these thousands and thousands of Palestinians who've been kidnapped by Israel. It all through our political culture. In this country, there's more focus on the feelings of some Jewish students at a university campus vis-a-vis a protest against the genocide than there is coverage of 30,000 Palestinians killed. Like, that's more important than some like feelings of somebody. So, all throughout the political culture, the racism is absolutely just, you know, oozing. And no, there's no doubt that if there was, you know, anything in the vicinity of what Israel's done, happening to you know, white people, to happening to our self-described allies, this would be, you know, the outrage and the opposition would be immediate and would put a stop to it.
Right. Well, I mean, isn't it all quite ironic when it is the West which created the Zionist entity, the West supports Zionism, and the West also supported Nazism? These ideologies were created by them, but were used as an excuse to steal Palestinian land and to commit a continuous genocide against the Palestinians.
Absolutely. The supremacist mentality is something that basically dominates their thought. They just differ on who is the chosen people. Actually, I was listening to a very powerful speech from Sheikh Imran Hussein. He was saying that this mental, spiritual, philosophical virus of this chosenism is what drives all the oppression that exists in the world today, that drives all the misery and bad things that we see in the world today. This idea that there is a group of inferior people and that some group of people are superior and they have a right to basically just do as they wish upon the so-called inferior peoples of the world, because either they're lesser humans in some cases, or sometimes they go even further and say that they're not humans at all, as is we're seeing here in the case of Palestine. So this is really a satanic ideology, because the first supremacist was Lucifer, Iblis himself, as the story in the Holy Quran demonstrates. So they can't claim that they're chosen of God when they're following such an evil satanic ideology. So they can only fool so many people for so long. But I think the world is actually waking up. And the fact that they're so masked off about it, if we can see all the people in Israeli Telegram chats cheering on when they see dead babies, when they see, like the other day, a man driven over by a bulldozer while he was still alive. They can't call themselves people of God when they're endorsing such wickedness and corruption on this earth.
Right. Well, Eves, the Israeli regime is not only dangerous for Palestinians, but to the whole region and world, as it has never had to abide by international law. Now, thus it bombs and assassinates at will. It is not only committing genocide in Gaza and murdering others in the West Bank, but it is invading the sovereignty of Lebanon and Syria and committing assassinations. Do you think that more countries are beginning to understand the dangers of this entity? And do you think that more countries will change their policies toward it?
Well, I think that what's happening in Latin America. Colombia announced yesterday or the day before that they were no more arms to Israel. You look at what Lula, the president of Brazil, said about the genocide. There's no doubt that that's it's growing sentiment. I saw Nicaragua brought Germany is bringing Germany to the International Court of Justice for their complicity in the genocide. So the rest of the world, aside from a handful of, you know, North American former European settler countries like Australia and some Western European countries, the vast majority of the world has been hostile to Zionism and Israel for a long time, and that's growing. I think that, you know, the people are just appalled by what they're seeing. Leaders, powerful people around the world, even appalled. I think also it's interesting to see the developments within the imperial core. If you look at what happened in Michigan in the U.S. state in the primary, you know, you had this really big support for the uncommitted. And this was a really, you know, grassroots campaign to oppose Joe Biden's genocidal policy. If you look at the election of George Galloway in Britain in the by-election a couple days ago, the people when they have a chance to, you know, weigh in on this question, there's a lot of dissent here in Montreal. It's unprecedented, the level of protests across Canada, tomorrow's going to be 22 weekends in a row of mass demonstrations against Canada's complicity in the genocide. So the opposition, even within those countries that are the ones that are heavily responsible for Israel's crimes, is growing. Now, you know, the U.S. empire is powerful, right? So they have a way of protecting Israel diplomatically. They have a way of making it difficult for countries like Brazil or Colombia or Nicaragua to really, you know, for that spirit of opposition to really grow. But I think that around the world, people and governments are just appalled by what Israel's doing.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I mean, the majority of the population in Gaza is on the brink of starvation. The U.S. says it will start airdropping food. Why doesn't Washington just demand that the genocide end immediately?
This is just one big PR move to let off steam, because the international pressure and the international PR debacle that the Zionists have done has really been to their own detriment. But they're too arrogant and they're too, I mean, they're psychopaths. Who would kill this many people and not have a few screws? So this is just something to buy a little bit of PR for the Zionist regime. I personally think it's a little bit odd that the United States, they actually did the airdrop already of 66 packages. I think, you know, anybody who's aware of the satanic numerology, I think that's a little bit odd for the U.S. to do after they support the genocide. This is... They're like basically stabbing the people in the back and then giving them a Band-Aid. It's incredibly hypocritical and sadistic, and it's as if they're mocking the Palestinians whom they've killed in the tens of thousands.
Well, Eves, I want you just to think about these statistics for a minute. Since October the 7th, more than 30,000 people have been killed, and even more because, of course, unfortunately, there's so many still under the rubble. At least 12,500 kids have been killed, averaging about 85, 90 kids a day being killed. Your thoughts on the type of regime that could do this to begin with?
Well, it's a regime that's obviously believes in a supremacist ideology. These are Jewish supremacists. Which has been what Zionism has been about for a long time, but these are real Jewish supremacist fanatics that are in charge. And alongside that is a government, a state apparatus that operates with impunity. And it has been told over and over again for decades that it can basically do whatever it wants and it will have the backing of the powerful forces. And, you know, just a really concrete example of that, you know, when the International Criminal Court began an investigation in 2020 into Israeli officials' war crimes, the Canadian government delivered a letter to the ICC saying, do not investigate Israeli war crimes, and threatened to cut off Canadian assistance to the ICC, which was a significant part of ICC budget. That's a really concrete message to the Israeli government to do whatever it wants to Palestinians. And, you know, there's many, many, many other examples of that. And so that's the nature of it. I agree. It is unequivocally a sadistic regime. I don't think, you know, there is a logic, I do think, to what they're doing here. I don't think they believe they're going to defeat Hamas or wipe Hamas out. I mean, I think there's some small element of wanting to do that, and obviously to, you know, kill Hamas fighters and resistance fighters. Israel wants to do that and has had a modest amount of success doing that. I don't think it believes it can actually just, you know, crush Hamas. But I do think it wants to drive, you know, everyone out of Gaza. That's if you care about a Jewish state, if your objective is a Jewish state, obviously the fact that there are more non-Jews in the region, that's a problem demographically for the Zionist entity. So if they could drive out hundreds of thousands, if not, you know, all of Palestinian population in Gaza, why wouldn't someone who you know is concerned about having a Jewish state and having a state based upon Jewish supremacy, why wouldn't they want to try to do that? And I think that's part of what they're trying to do. It's horrendous. It's you know, it's completely supremacist, but there is a logic to it from the perspective of this European colonial supremacist outpost that we call Israel.
Well, Ali, are you optimistic about the possibility of a ceasefire taking place before the month of Ramadan, as Egypt will host more talks?
If I remember correctly, in 2014, during that war or that slaughter, or that kind of, although it's a mini or mini, at the time I called it, and many other people were calling it a genocide, but it seems like a mini genocide compared to what it is today, unfortunately. The Zionists at that time had pledged to make, and it was during the time of Ramadan, I remember because it was my first time as doing Ramadan as a new Muslim. They pledged to make it the darkest Ramadan in history. So I don't think the Israelis will have any kind of humanity. I mean, they don't have any humanity anyways, but they certainly won't extend it, perhaps not even for a PR win during the holy month of Ramadan. And I don't trust the Egyptians or the Qataris enough to broker an honest ceasefire that would not let the blood of all these martyrs go to waste. So I think the ultimate guarantor of any ceasefire will be the arms of the resistance, because they are humiliating the Zionist regime. How many billions of dollars are they losing per day just in the Zionist entity alone due to the situation in northern occupied Palestine, thanks to Hezbollah, and also the areas surrounding Gaza, as well as Yemen and Iraq's strikes against the southern tip of Eilat, I believe is the name. And then just the global ramifications on the shipping routes, thanks to particularly to Yemen and Ansarullah. So I believe that the pressure from the resistance will secure a type of ceasefire whose terms are beneficial to the resistance. They may not get 100% of what they're asking for, but they will get enough where it humiliates the Zionist regime, it secures a victory for their people, and the death of all these martyrs.